Good morning, this is Jane DeGrenier, reading on Sunday, February 15th, reading City Journal. We will continue with an article we started last week, The Hidden Tax on Your Power Bill, by Eric Olson, Jack Dormany, and Jason M. Walter. The problem persists with renewable energy. Modern renewable energy generation has far lower spatial power density than compact thermal plants such as nuclear or natural gas. This means that less power is generated or delivered per unit area and that more space is required to produce the same amount of power. Therefore, renewable projects require more extensive collector systems and longer haul transmission corridors. Peer-reviewed estimates of life cycle, surface power density place utility-scale photovoltaic solar generation at 6 to 7 watts per square meter and utility-scale wind generation at 1 to 2. By comparison, nuclear power has a surface power density of 200 to 500, while natural gas combined cycle plants average 500 to 1,000. This mismatch means that replacing a single 1,000-megawatt coal-fired generating unit operating at 70% capacity factor, which would produce about 6.1 terawatt-hours of electricity per year, would require about 2,800 MW of photovoltaic solar capacity operating at a 25% CF, or 2,000 to 2,300 MW of wind capacity operating at 33 to 36% CF, depending on site performance. Building at that scale in a remote, windy, or sunny area entails new high-voltage lines. Today, 765 kilovolt alternating current transmission line segments routinely cost $5 to $6 million per mile, even before stations are built to receive them, with CWIP eligibility subject to FERC approval. The result is a swelling number of grid mega projects whose economics depends on speculative generation forecasts, but whose financing costs are front-loaded onto ratepayers. The following case studies show a consistent pattern. Whenever CWIP allows early recovery, costs expand and risks shift to customers. Consider the Potomac Appalachian Transmission High Line PATH. Proposed as a 765 kV line to carry West Virginia coal power into the regional grid operator, PJM's load centers, PATH entered PJM's regional plan and obtained federal incentive approvals, but never received state certificates in any of the three jurisdictions that it crossed. Opposition from landowners and environmental groups was fierce. By 2012, load forecasts had fallen to the extent that PJM canceled the project. Yet PJM ratepayers nevertheless paid $250 million in development costs. Commissioner Christie summarized it as not a single ounce of steel in the ground, yet hundreds of millions of dollars were recovered from customers, and he attributed the bill directly to the commission's granting of CWIP and other incentives. Dominion's Coastal Virginia Offshore Wind Project serves as another example. The Virginia State Corporation Commission noted that Rider OSW, Dominion Energy Virginia's offshore wind rate adjustment clause that recovers the revenue requirement for the CVOW project, is largely a return on construction work in progress until the project enters commercial operation. CVOW is a 2.6 GW offshore wind development, currently about 50% complete, with Dominion projecting completion by the end of 2026 at an estimated cost of $10.7 billion. The expected cost reflects ongoing PJM network upgrade requirements, which remain one of the largest unfixed inputs into the project. A wind farm of this scale involves extensive inter-array and export cabling, hundreds of miles of subsea feeder lines, and supporting infrastructure that can be placed in the rate base and that can earn a return during construction through Rider OSW. Beyond the project footprint itself, additional long-haul transmission is often required to integrate new generation into the grid. Florida Power and Light's Port Everglades Next Generation Clean Energy Center, on the other hand, was capitalized with financing costs under AFUDC and did not recover carrying costs from customers until the plant entered service. The project was commissioned in April 2016, matching the publicly stated 2016 in-service timeline, at which point AFUDC capitalization stopped and costs moved into the rate base through the normal post-COD treatment. Thus, any pre-service charges to customers were avoided. The plant's efficiency improvements were expected to lower fuel burn and produce lifetime customer savings, illustrating AFUDC's discipline relative to CWIP's early recovery model. Limiting or eliminating CWIP's early recovery privileges would not halt the construction of bona fide infrastructure development. It would simply ensure that the next generation of energy investment is driven by efficiency and prudence rather than by an accounting rule that rewards spending for its own sake. The savings to be had are significant. Some consumer advocacy groups estimate that the construction of nuclear power plants overrun costs by an average of 100%, costing roughly twice their initial estimate. Reform options. The choice between CWIP and AFUDC represents only the most basic policy decision. A range of reforms could restore market discipline and consumer protection. FERC could make CWIP approvals conditional, make CWIP rates of return performance-based, and utilities meeting schedule and budget benchmarks would earn their full authorized return while those experiencing delays or overruns would face automatic reductions in the CWIP return rate. Cost escalation beyond approved baselines would trigger immediate refund mechanisms, ensuring that ratepayers do not subsidize poor project management. Another common sense approach would be to include automatic clawback provisions that would create enforceable mechanisms to recover customer payments when projects are abandoned or costs exceed predetermined thresholds. Rather than using the current system where customers bear stranded investments risks, utilities would face meaningful financial consequences for project failures. Restricted change orders under CWIP could lock the scope of a project and the cost before approval. Relevant commissions would pre-authorize a not-to-exceed CWIP amount based on the project and required costs. Any variance exceeding a certain threshold would suspend CWIP accruals until the project is reauthorized. Limited exceptions may be allowed for regulatory compliance of unforeseen circumstances. All other cost increases would be excluded from CWIP recovery and thereby absorbed by owners or shareholders. For load pockets driven by data and AI campuses, an option is to move the load off the regulated grid entirely. Authorizing truly off-grid providers channels private capital into self-contained microgrids and on-site generation. This avoids CWIP in the rate base. New Hampshire's HB672-FN provides a template by creating a category for off-grid electricity providers that generate, transmit, distribute, and sell power to at retail to on-site customers while remaining independent of the state's transmission and distribution systems. An off-grid supplier that does not use public rights of way or interconnect with the grid is not treated as a public utility and is exempt from most utility statutes, while still complying with siting and other generally applicable laws. If an off-grid project later interconnects or uses public corridors, it immediately becomes fully regulated, which preserves consumer protections and keeps risk with investors until broadly available service begins. The complete elimination of CWIP in the rate base probably represents the best reform. Eliminating CWIP would enforce utilities to finance construction through traditional debt and equity markets, earning returns only after projects deliver service. The interstate MVP's financing structure shows that major infrastructure projects can attract private capital without yearly rate recovery, provided that investors face genuine market discipline. These reform options are not mutually exclusive. The key principle underlying all these alternatives is the realignment of risk and reward so that the incentives are aligned in such a way that those who benefit from project success should also bear the consequences of project failure. In conclusion, CWIP is a cautionary tale about how well-intentioned financial tools can distort incentives and shift risks when applied without safeguards. Originally promoted as a way to help utilities weather the capital strain of large, long-lead projects, CWIP has repeatedly weakened cost disciplines, encouraged oversizing, and transferred the financial burden of speculation onto households and businesses. Historical episodes in Missouri and New Hampshire during the nuclear build-out of the 1970s and 1980s revealed these risks vividly. Ratepayers paid billions for reactors that never delivered power, and utilities stumbled into bankruptcy despite early cost recovery. Those lessons appeared to set limits, but the Energy Policy Act of 2005 and FERC's Order 679 reopened the door by extending CWIP to transmission, again transferring risk to consumers in the name of grid modernization. Georgia's Plant Vogtle demonstrates how CWIP can sustain multi-decade construction programs even as costs more than double, with families paying surcharges for years before receiving electricity. Mississippi's Kemper Clean Coal Project and Dominion's offshore wind build show that CWIP's distortions are not limited to any one technology. The common thread is that once cash recovery begins, every delay and change order expands the rate base and makes the utility less affordable for the customer. Transmission megaprojects such as PATH reveal the same flaw on a regional scale. Customers in several states paid hundreds of millions for a line that never received state approval or entered service. Taken together, these examples validate the concerns of the critics. CWIP, especially when coupled with abandonment recovery, makes consumers both the lender and the insurer for speculative infrastructure. The average Johnson effect, the incentive to overinvest capital under cost of service regulation, is magnified when utilities can earn a guaranteed return before an asset is even in service. The result is a feedback loop of larger projects, longer timelines, and higher costs, all of which still generate guaranteed returns for shareholders, while ratepayers should shoulder the risk. A broader return to AFUDC would require federal and state actions in tandem. FERC should withdraw CWIP in rate-based incentives under its transmission incentive policies, and states, through legislatures, public service commissions, or voter initiatives, where applicable, should repeal or revise statutes and orders that authorize CWIP recovery in retail rates. How AI Can Empower School Choice by Jonah Davids. A school choice revolution has swept America. Following pandemic-era school closures and culture wars, choice proponents have made unprecedented gains at the state and federal levels. Today, 34 states have adopted some form of school choice, with 1.5 million students participating. The rise of widely available artificial intelligence, AI, tools constitutes a quieter but no less profound education revolution. Large language models, LLMs, like ChatGPT, can deliver quality, individualized education at little to no cost. Teachers increasingly use the technology to create lessons, assignments, and assessments, and educational technology firms are rapidly integrating AI into their products. As AI advances, the cost of pure instruction, unbundled from childcare, mentoring, and other human services, will fall dramatically. AI tutors like Khan Academy's Khanmigo and SpaceX's Synthesis cost just $4 and $29 per month, respectively. Tools like these will empower leaner models of education, such as micro-home and hybrid schooling, and help build out the growing school choice movement. Alpha School, an innovative private school with locations across the country, offers a glimpse of where this policy-tech combination may be headed. Alpha students spend 2 hours every day studying a digital AI-integrated curriculum. They spend the rest of their time developing life skills and pursuing passion projects. The adults in the building called guides don't teach. Instead, they provide oversight, leaving the subject matter instruction to the technology and, in some cases, on-call tutors. Most of Alpha School's current offerings are expensive, but the company is growing and diversifying. Today, it offers micro-campuses for student-athletes and is planning low-cost schools that will be covered almost entirely by state vouchers. Other institutions like Primer Micro Schools are proving it's possible to offer a similar model of micro-schooling to middle- and low-income families in states with education savings accounts. As more schools embrace individualized and AI-powered instruction, students will be free to move through the curriculum at their own pace, allowing them to master the material. This development will also make grade acceleration policies, which allow students to advance to the next grade immediately after completing their current grade's coursework, more common. Of course, we should be wary of AI's effects. For one, not all AI tools are created equal. Some tools, like learning platforms with generative AI integrated, give feedback after students answer a question. A standard LLM, by contrast, can simply give students the answer outright, facilitating cheating and undermining kids' ability to learn the material. We also haven't seen AI adopted at scale. Alpha School claims its students learn 2.6 times faster than average, but as the technology reaches more classrooms, we may find that that average student struggles to work with AI as he would with a human teacher. Some students may learn best from group activities such as call and response, which aren't possible in the personalized AI-driven approach. School choice proponents must also reckon with AI's ideological biases. Popular LLMs lean left, and as the technology reaches more classrooms, companies, regulators, and legislators will be tempted to entrench that bias. These models' political biases could undermine educators' ability to promulgate their school's values. The solution to these issues is markets, such as parents have had to educate themselves on phonics, critical race theory, and other pedagogical topics to evaluate what their children are learning in school. Parents will also have to learn about AI when choosing a school for their children. If parents demand it, the market will provide AI tools and programming tuned to various value systems, liberal and conservative, secular and theistic, strict and supportive. Homeschoolers, microschoolers, and others on the education frontier should experiment with AI-powered models. Education researchers should study those models' effectiveness, and policymakers should work to ensure a competitive, pluralistic playing field. Now is the time to test AI's potential in education and to build the future of the school choice movement. Canada's Statistical Agency wants more details on non-binary children, by Colin Wright. On December 8th, members of the Toronto chapter of FLAG, a volunteer group dedicated to creating a caring, just, and affirming world for LGBTQ plus people and those who love them, received an unusual email. The organization said that while it rarely shares survey requests from third parties, it was making an exception for a trusted partner, Statistics Canada. The Federal Statistical Agency published gender identity data for people 15 and older in 2022. But many Canadians may not know that it has also collected this information for children age 0 to 14. Now, the agency wants to put input on how to present this data publicly. The email sent to FLAG solicited parental feedback on how to produce and release information on transgender and non-binary children and youth. A 10-page consultation guide was attached to the email titled Transgender and Non-Binary Children and Youth Data Dissemination. The guide's authors claim that releasing this data will contribute to strengthening evidence-based decision-making to inform programs and services for these populations. That sounds reasonable enough until one grasps the implications that infants and toddlers have a gender identity, that this identity can differ from their sex, and that governments must know this information so that they can design programs and services around these presumed identities. The guide accepts these tenuous premises in its opening paragraph, explaining that its goal is to publish the data in a way that does not cause undue harm to gender-diverse children and youth. In its objective and confidentiality section, the guide purports to summarize relevant background from national statistical organizations, academic and other gray literature, and common public discourse. But instead of accurately relaying known facts, it presents a heavily distorted account of child development aimed to help parents identify their young children's supposed gender identity. First, the authors claim that children and youth are often assumed to be cisgender, identifying with their biological sex, from birth until they come out as a different gender on their own accord. They cite a study that purportedly demonstrates that children age 18 to 24 months are developmentally capable of recognizing gender norms and expressing gender behaviors in visible ways. But the study and the broader developmental psychology literature do not say that toddlers recognize gender norms. What they actually show is that children begin developing the ability to distinguish males from females based on perceptual cues like faces and voices between 1 and 2 years of age. This has nothing to do with recognition of a subjective inner self, sense of self. Later in that paragraph, the guide claims that children may mimic gender norms and roles learned from people in their environment, assert their desire for certain clothing, hairstyles, or other accessories, and choose to play with toys that match their gender identity. Apparently, the authors believe that if toddlers play with a doll or a truck, they are expressing their gender identity, and that adults should interpret such behavior as a window into the child's internal psychological state. Things become even more speculative from there. The guide's authors claim that transgender and non-binary children may recognize and express their gender to others from as early as 2 to 3 years old. But the studies they're gesturing at show nothing of the kind. In reality, they report the ages at which parents socially transitioned their children, not when children formed a stable internal sense of identity. A 3-year-old boy who prefers his hair long is not announcing that he is a girl. Rather, parents who affirm their boy is a girl for such reasons are revealing their ideology. Next, the guide turns to the concept of gender. The authors claim that it is normal for a child's gender to change over time and that children do not experience undue harm from exploring their gender in ways that differ from their assumed gender or sex at birth. But while most forms of imagination-based play are normal and harmless, like pretending to be a superhero or one's favorite Disney character, in today's clinical and educational environment, gender exploration is often paired with social affirmation, which in turn often begets puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones. One of the guide's most remarkable sections concerns data collection. Statistics Canada admits that gender identity data for children under 12 comes mostly from proxy reporting parents or household members declaring a child's gender identity on the child's behalf. Rather than viewing this as a limitation on its data's reliability, the guide treats it as a fixable flaw in parental judgment. It suggests that proxy data may be distorted because the gender of a child is often assumed based on sex at birth. At the same time, it notes that some parents now label their infants as non-binary by default until the child says otherwise. Instead of concluding that gender identity is unmeasurable in very young children, the guide suggests that providing parents with gender diversity information from birth or an early age will produce more reliable data. Throughout the document, the authors suggest that public resistance to or skepticism about concepts like gender fluidity, cisnormativity, and transnormativity is a result of misunderstanding, and that this ignorance is fueling legislation concerning pronoun usage, access to gender-affirming health care, and sports participation. The guide also asks respondents whether they anticipate a negative reaction from certain groups if gender identity data for young children are published, again implying that such a reaction would be rooted in prejudice. What the guide never addresses is its central conceptual problem, the idea of a transgender or non-binary child, which depends on the false belief that everyone has an innate internal gender identity separate from their sex, and that this identity is discernible even in babies and toddlers. Yet no compelling evidence supports this claim. What activists interpret as signs of an internal gender identity, preferences, behaviors, personality traits, all reflect normal variations among boys and girls. Nevertheless, the guide proceeds as though the innateness of transgenderism were a settled matter, as if labeling an infant non-binary were as scientifically valid as recording his or her birth weight. When a national statistics agency adopts contested metaphysical beliefs as objective data points, it does more than mismeasure reality. It distorts people's perception of reality, and these perceptions shape school policies, medical guidelines, and government programs. Statistics Canada is not just proposing to publish data, it is proposing to institutionalize an ideology that pathologizes ordinary childhood behavior and funnels children towards social and medical transitions. The consultation guide reads less like a technical survey than an ideological document attempting to create the very phenomenon it claims only to want to measure. An anti-ICE movement increasingly run by revolutionaries, by Stu Smith. As public support wanes, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, has become the target of nationwide protests. While many of these protests are peaceful and popular, they have also created an opening for aggressive activist networks with long histories of revolutionary politics. Some of these groups are moving beyond lawful dissent, with organizers and online channels increasingly promoting confrontation, disruption, and other unlawful actions against federal authorities. Two leading anti-ICE groups are Central Community Service Organizations, CSO, and the Freedom Road Socialist Organization, FRSO. Both have been subject to federal scrutiny, including raids by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Working variously through local chapters and affiliate networks, both groups have pushed militancy into protests that were once nonviolent. Even organizations in the progressive mainstream, including the Sunrise Movement and the 5051, have become entangled in this ecosystem through coalition alignment and tactical approaches that involve knowledge, legal violations, or heightened legal exposure. What began as criticism of federal immigration policy is now tied up with illegal targeted agitation campaigns. Anti-ICE Democrats and centrists need to take responsibility for policing their movements, or they risk being seen as willing participants in escalating radicalism. Much of this radical momentum is channeled through FRSO, which plays a central role in big tent coalitions. These coalitions often coalesce around popular causes such as opposition to President Donald Trump and offer logistical infrastructure for protests ranging from social media promotion to on-the-ground leadership, along with established networks of allies prepared to mobilize in the streets of a moment's notice. FRSO chapters are listed as a member and steering committee member, respectively, of the People's Action Coalition Against Trump in Minnesota and the Coalition Against the Trump Agenda in Chicago. While mainstream progressives are often attracted to these groups, FRSO does not necessarily consider the normal left its allies. Mira Altabel Resendez, an organizer for the Minnesota Immigrant Rights Action Committee, MIRAC, an FRSO member, made that clear on a podcast earlier this month. All of our movements that have been active here in Minneapolis have an enemy with Jacob Frey and with Tim Walz. In the same podcast interview, Altabel Resendez mocked what she described as Governor Tim Walz's threat to deploy the National Guard to keep down riots, arguing that politicians use the word riots to describe people who are rightfully expressing their anger at this system. Despite criticizing some elected Democrats, Altabel Resendez has collaborated publicly with others, including at a protest with Representative Ilhan Omar. This demonstrates how easily FRSO affiliates move between mainstream Democratic and radical activist spaces. But Altabel Resendez is a committed radical and has supported illegal actions. On a recent FRSO webinar, she stated, "Just because, like, something is illegal doesn't mean that we won't do it," before adding a caveat about not wanting to put us in hot water. She is just one cog in a broader network that includes more mainstream organizations such as Black Lives Matter and the anti-Trump organization 50501, both of whose Minnesota chapters are part of a coalition with FRSO Twin Cities and the eco-activist Sunrise Movement. Sunrise partnered with Altabel Resendez organization MIRAC to target hotels hosting ICE agents, banging pots and pans and pressing car horns in a wake-up operation. Leaders within the Sunrise Movement have openly acknowledged their awareness that these actions can violate the law. Some of the most fervent and sometimes violent anti-ICE activity has happened in California. One of the leading anti-ICE organizers in the region is Centro CSO. The group emerged in the 1990s by reviving and repurposing the historic CSO name associated with its predecessor, the community service organization which trained Cesar Chavez. Carlos Montes has led Centro CSO since the 1990s. During this period, he self-recruited into the Freedom Road Socialist Organization, FRSO. He reportedly believed a revolutionary organization such as FRSO would better aid him in the fight for Chicano liberation and socialism. He is not the only Centro CSO member also to be in FRSO. Centro CSO is also listed as a supporting organization for the National Legalization for All Network, a large coalition of activists and groups advocating for the legalization of all illegal immigrants. Leaders of Centro CSO are clear about the tactics they endorse. At a major conference in Chicago this past fall, one member described confronting ICE vehicles in Los Angeles. "You should have seen how scared they were when a couple dozen Chicanos surrounded their unmarked black-tinted truck," Gabriel Juarez Jr., a Centro CSO member, said. He mentioned that a number of Waymo cars caught fire by accident, prompting laughter from the audience. On a separate movement call late last month, FRSO member, Legalization for All signatory, and Centro CSO leader Carlos Montes highlighted a spontaneous upsurge of thousands of young people that took over the streets and occupied freeways in Los Angeles for a day in February 2025 to protest the Trump administration. He called the effort a community self-defense coalition. According to Montes, these actions have inspired a whole new generation of young activists to join Centro CSO. On that same call, Marisol Marquez, a member of FRSO, Centro CSO, and Legalization for All, noted that the Legalization for All network trained activists in other cities on barrio walks, rapid response networks, and coordinated responses to ICE activity during attempted raids. Centro CSO's tactics and ideas are spreading into the mainstream anti-ICE movement, too. Ron Goches, a leading academic activist who has been involved in ICE Watch activities, publicly thanked the group for leading a local protest. Centro CSO also hosted the Emergency Southwest Summit Against Deportations, which was attended by more than 150 activists and featured workshops on topics like how to set up rapid response systems and barrio organizing, fighting deportations, how to fight foreign winds, sanctuary cities and schools, and how to build coalitions to fight back. FRSO and Centro CSO have faced federal scrutiny in recent years. Last summer, the FBI seized electronics from a Centro CSO member and raided another's home. That second member was arrested and charged, though the Department of Justice later dropped the charges. Federal focus on these groups is not restricted to the Trump administration. During President Barack Obama's first term, Montes and other FRSO leaders faced raids of their own. The Department of Justice also investigated the Organization for Material Support of Terrorism. It remains unclear why the DOJ did not pursue charges. Popular animus toward ICE has created an opening for the FRSO and Centro CSO. These groups' goal is not merely reform. The goal, as FRSO member Chrisley Carpio put it, is to lead ever larger numbers of people into confrontations with the enemy. In spite of this radicalism, groups like FRSO and Centro CSO are increasingly welcomed into the anti-ICE tent. Progressives can police their movements to drive out such radicals or risk giving in to their most dangerous ideas. The Answer to AI's Power Problem, Free Markets, by Craig R. Roach and John Garnett. Artificial intelligence, AI, companies may be booming, but they're still struggling to get around a fundamental constraint, an insatiable demand for electricity. The federal government isn't likely to help them. I never want Americans to pay higher electricity bills because of data centers, President Donald Trump has said, insisting that big tech companies pay their own way. This is the right approach. Ensuring that AI companies pay their full construction and operating costs will not only make electricity affordable again, but will also encourage these companies to innovate. To get there, we need regulatory reforms at both the state and federal levels aimed at ensuring that price signals, not government intervention, determine the trajectory for data center growth. These reforms should include rolling back any remaining federal-level Inflation Reduction Act policies and state-level renewable portfolio standards, coupled with congressionally mandated permitting reform. These steps will lay the foundation for AI to flourish long into the future. Last month, President Trump's National Energy Dominance Council announced a consensus view on AI data centers. They must pay the full cost of their power needs, not pass these costs on to consumers. This view brought together a bipartisan group of federal and state-level politicians, including all 13 governors, 8 Democrats, 5 Republicans, representing the states within the PJM Interconnection Regional Electricity Grid. PJM is the largest electricity grid operator in the U.S., serving more than 65 million people and powering more data centers than any other region. The PJM region includes Virginia, home to 35% of all hyperscale data centers in the world. Affordability is central to this bipartisan consensus. Residential electricity bills have risen 10% since 2022. While electricity charges for the data centers driving the greater electricity demand have increased by just 4%. More worrisome still, data centers' demand for electricity is expected to grow. The Department of Energy projects it will double or triple by 2028, and the Energy Information Administration recently forecasted the strongest four-year growth in U.S. electricity demand since 2000, fueled by data centers. How do we meet our growing electricity needs? The answer is simple. Get government out of the way. The states and the federal government should insist that data centers secure their expected electricity needs under long-term procurements without putting taxpayers on the hook for unneeded investment. No public underwriting of data center costs. At the same time, data centers must be free to source their power from the wide range of energy sources available in the U.S., especially cheap, abundant natural gas, and that means deregulation. First, state legislatures and Congress need to roll back regulations found in the Inflation Reduction Act and in the RPS, which mandate that utilities must procure a minimum share of electricity from renewable sources. The majority of states have implemented RPS. Repeal would allow lower-cost electricity for data centers and residential consumers. The federal government has subsidized the RPS through tax credits, including ones created by the Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act. President Biden's policies muzzled natural gas production and subsidized other forms of expensive energy, especially solar and wind. Despite his own administration's findings that natural gas was 3.3 times cheaper than electricity for residential power needs in 23 and 24. These regulations should be eliminated, or at a minimum, exceptions should be carved out for data centers. Congress must also enact meaningful permitting reform. At a recent United States Energy Association forum, a collection of associations representing all energy sources, including natural gas, nuclear hydropower, solar, and wind, agreed. Lengthy, antiquated permitting processes were preventing them from bringing critical energy infrastructure projects online. Forcing AI companies to pay their fair share of electricity costs will also encourage innovation. To remain profitable, firms will need to develop new ideas and products that take the cost of energy into consideration. Some big tech companies are already trying to do this, using direct purchase agreements and on-site power generation to bypass the grid. Other forward-thinking companies have looked for ways to boost computing power and efficiency. For example, quantum computing could reduce the energy needs for some AI tasks by up to 90%. Other businesses may explore decentralized data centers as a way to reduce costs, improve reliability, and mitigate security risks. At present, AI companies are like Icarus, flying too close to the sun with wax wings. Smart policy choices, in this case, forcing AI companies into a truly free market without subsidies, will keep those wings from melting. Blue State's Demographic Nightmare by Steve Melania. The Democratic Party has come a long way from 1996, when President Bill Clinton's reelection campaign declared that America cannot tolerate illegal immigration and added, "We continue to firmly oppose welfare benefits for illegal immigrants." When we seek explanations for why today's Democrats refuse to call those here without permission illegal, oppose lawful deportations, and seek government benefits for those who've snuck into the country, we probably need to look no further than the population woes of democratic states at a time when states are governed increasingly by one party or another. The latest migration trends released last week show Americans continuing to move heavily away from states with politics dominated by Democrats and toward Republican locales, significantly shifting population, political power, and economic resources. The latest data for the year ending July 1, 2025, show that 7 of the top 10 states gaining residents from elsewhere in the country are all governed by so-called Republican trifectas, in which the party controls the governorship in both legislative houses, including Texas, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Georgia. The remaining 3 states in the top 10, North Carolina, Arizona, and Nevada, went for Trump in 2024 and have divided governments that lean Republican. Of the 22 states where Republicans control all branches of government, only 3 lost population to net migration in the last year. In 2 of those, Mississippi and Nebraska, the net decline was less than 1,000. In all, Republican states gained a net of nearly 345,000 people from other places. By contrast, Democratic states dominate the list of places where the biggest outflow of residents. 9 of the 10 states losing the most population are Democratic, led by California with a net loss of 229,000 residents, and including New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, and Illinois. A notable addition to the bottom 10 is Colorado, a politically competitive state as recently as 2019, but dominated by Democrats since. Unlike California and New York, which have seen net out-migration for more than a decade, Colorado's fortunes have only recently turned, but dramatically so, as the state recorded the 8th highest net loss of residents last fiscal year. Only 4 of the 15 Democratic trifecta states last year gained residents: Washington, Oregon, Delaware, and Maine. In all, Democratic-led states lost about 495,000 residents to net migration. This trend has been building for years. A decade ago, when Gallup asked residents of every state whether they intended to move elsewhere, Democratic states dominated the ranks of places people wanted to leave. Analysts found a strong relationship between total state tax burden and desire to leave one's current state of residence. It wasn't clear whether most of those discontented residents wanted to move elsewhere, specifically because of taxes, or whether taxes were just a marker for a big government ethos that pervades other areas of life as well. But the result was the same. When COVID-19 emerged, the policy and governing differences between red and blue states widened further, as Democrats were more likely to lock down society, including schools, longer, to institute more draconian restrictions on businesses, and to offset any declines in government revenues from these stoppages with higher taxes. Outmigration subsequently soared. Now, post-COVID, state policy differences have heightened in everything from transsexual rights to opposition to deportation to taxation. The latest census numbers illustrate why Democrats have been anxious to welcome immigrants, legal or not, and see that they get counted in the decennial tally. With the border effectively closed, the populations of states like California, Hawaii, and New Mexico are declining, and they're stagnating in New York, Illinois, and Massachusetts. Meantime, populations are growing significantly more in southwestern and southeastern states like Texas, South Carolina, and Tennessee. Compounding the problem is that Democratic-leaning states have some of the lowest total fertility rates. In 2023, 9 of the 11 states with a birth rate of 1.5 children per woman or less were Democratic states. The blue state with the highest birth rate, New Jersey, ranks only 18th nationally, behind such Republican trifectas as South Dakota, Texas, Arkansas, and Utah. These demographic shifts are showing up everywhere from politics to economics. In the last 20 years, Florida and Texas alone have gained 9 electoral votes, while New York, Illinois, and California have lost 6. Projections based on current population trends suggest that in the next census, Texas and Florida may each pick up 2 or more votes, while California and New York could lose 2 or more electors. Illinois, Minnesota, Oregon, and Wisconsin are among those states which could lose a single vote. Economically, power has already shifted. The stark contrast in tax and budget policy among states during COVID showed in the rapid revival of the economies in Republican locales. A mid-2020 study documented the way Republican states had already added back 341,000 jobs, while Democratic states were still struggling with losses of 1.3 million positions from COVID lockdowns, robust gains in everything from retail sales to home listings in Republican states followed on the heels of massive migration, as some 46 million people moved in response to COVID. A year later, a Bloomberg analysis found that the largely Republican southeastern states and Texas had, as a region, surpassed the northeastern states in contribution to the nation's gross domestic product. A 2024 study of patterns throughout COVID further documented the massive movement of workers in their prime employment years and their families out of major metro areas in states like New York, California, and Illinois, and into counties in places like Central Texas, Tennessee, Georgia, the Carolinas, and Florida, among other Republican areas. Looking at these results, one might conclude that Democratic voters and the politicians they elect would consider reforms to keep and attract more voters. But states like California, New York, and Illinois have been racking up losses for more than a decade with no sign of political change. If anything, Democratic states seem to be pressing ahead with the very policies that repel a substantial number of citizens and businesses. During the Biden years, Democrats decided that the solution to this problem was to import a cohort of new voters. That immigration policy, ironically, had as much to do with the improbable re-election of Trump as any other Democratic strategy. The great Scottish Enlightenment thinker Adam Smith once observed that there is a great deal of ruin in a nation. Today, you might describe the process as managed decline. It's a feat that many Democratic states are pulling off quite convincingly. San Diego State Wants Students to Interrogate Capitalism by John D. Saylor. At San Diego State University, SDSU, ethnic studies students are learning to approach their internships with a decolonial perspective and to challenge the colonizer logic of work. Thanks to funding from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, the university now offers a course called Ethnic and Gender Studies in the Workplace, part of a broader project to apply the principles of ethnic studies beyond the campus. The Building Decolonized Internship Pipelines project, which SDSU launched last year, seeks to address a problem endemic to women's gender, sexuality, and ethnic studies, area studies departments. Their students are routinely underemployed. Our alumni are slower to receive promotions, and many graduates remain underemployed, working part-time positions, notes the project's grant proposal, which I acquired via a public records request. These former students' failures supposedly stem from a deficit model, whereby employers see area studies students as inherently unwilling or incapable of participating in the hegemonic workforce. To address this perception and presumably to improve students' chances at gainful employment, the project proposes an unconventional approach, applying decolonial ideology. To counter deficit models of area studies students, the project aims to create a Navigating the Workplace course, an internship program from a decolonial perspective, the grant proposal said. In practice, this means teaching students to be skeptical of the colonizer logic of work. That logic, the proposal noted, seeks to indoctrinate and police students into uncritical, non-self-reflecting citizens who do not interrogate the relationship between capitalism and minoritized cultural practices, values, and traditions. One of the SDSU's initiative's key activities is developing an ethnic and gender studies in the workplace course. This course teaches students how to interrogate capitalism and minoritized cultural practices, values, and traditions while challenging and resisting white supremacy, racism, and hate, misogyny, homophobia, transphobia, ableism, imperialism, and contemporary colonialism that are deeply entangled with professional workplaces. The new course is seemingly designed to make area study students even less employable. The proposal notes that the course will encourage students to question specialization because specialized work can create professional identities that center self rather than identities grounded in community and its betterment. It will also retain solidarity and allyship, which is anti-ethical to upward mobility and individual recognition prized in many workplaces. Employers will likely be wary of a decolonized approach, anticipating that the proposal outlines how administrators will communicate with community partners, the companies that might actually offer students internships. They will know, the proposal says, that while profit might be a necessary component for nonprofit companies, a critical consciousness about work and the extraction of labor from students can be complicated and filled with tensions as students navigate trying to imagine a world beyond a late capitalism while also operating within its parameters. In the recent Wall Street Journal article, I described the Mellon Foundation's activist turn. The country's largest funder of the humanities has embraced a political agenda single-mindedly focused on advancing social justice. SDSU's project offers a small but poignant example of the consequences. The Mellon-funded project sets out to teach students that the workplace is oppressive and to prepare them to challenge it. By making students less prepared for post-college life, the Mellon Foundation continues to undermine the case for the humanities.